You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Real UW hashtag is helping UW students share their stories about race-related encounters on campus. We'll talk to a recent UW grad about his experiences and why he says it's time for change.
The Real UW hashtag, it's been around for a while on social media, but in recent months it's been picking up steam anew as students of color at the UW campus share it, to share their stories about race discrimination on campus.
UW-Madison administrators have said they're listening to the conversation unfolding. They recently responded by calling for a cultural competency pilot program and more counseling services, along with other changes.
A student with UW-Madison's First Wave program is credited with restarting the Real UW hashtag after a fellow student in her residence hall spit in her face and made derogatory comments about her race and her scholarship status.
Michael Penn II is a recent graduate of UW-Madison and the First Wave program. He's been part of the Real UW hashtag conversation on social media. We spoke with him late last week in studio. In the sharing of his studio, Penn used language that some listeners might find offensive.
Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how would you say that the Real UW stories are unfolding? What kind of effect is that having?
It's another hashtag in a slew of narratives that tie us all together. It's actually not a new hashtag. I'm not sure what it was that incited this to pop up the way it did, but I think it was a certain string of incidents. There's been about 3 or 4 racially charged incidents in the last month or so on UW's campus, and one day I woke up and it just started popping. So
How often were students using this hashtag?
I haven't seen it very often. I've seen it faintly, but as of late, it was just a week straight of people going in, and I felt like I had to go in too. So it's beautiful to just see, like, even if it is very digital, it's beautiful to see this camaraderie, and it's horrifying. It's horrific to see just what Black students go through, what Latino students go through, what first-generation kids go through, what women go through, what queer folks go through, It's a lot to take in. In fact, I found a lot of difficulty in peeling myself away from it, but it's just when you scroll and see all these thoughts just juxtaposed side by side, and you get to see just how ridiculous a lot of our peers, a lot of our classmates are, it hurts you. You know, it grips you. It's just difficult. It's really difficult to reconcile with, to see we're still having the same conversations over and over again. And administration wants to try to do what it can to turn that narrative, to control the narrative, to say they're listening, but apparently listening is not the solution.
And you're a graduate of UW-Madison. You were a member of the First Wave program, too. Did you see the same kind of thing when you were still in school that just wasn't a hashtag maybe to go with it?
First, I have an anecdote I love to tell. The first time I even stepped off the plane from Maryland, right? So I didn't know what to expect. I don't know if it was cornfields or what. I had nothing. Like, my father told me, you'll see it when you get there. Like, I didn't even get to visit here. So I got off, and I went to Red Robin. I think it was around University Avenue or so. And I was having food with my family because I like bottomless french fries. You know, like, bottomless french fries are lit, you know? So I was I was sitting there, and we come from a Black suburb. We come from, like, a Black area. It's rare to just be in an entire space full of white people. We step in this place. There's nothing but white people. The only non-white people are busing and waiting tables. And we sit down to eat, me, my mom, my dad, and my sister. And there's a super old white couple, probably like late 60s, early 70s, that are just staring at us every time we look to our left. They're staring like they've never seen us before. Which, as I've moved forward in my career here, it's like, that's not uncommon. Like, I'm going to class and I'm living by people who may not have lived by any person of color at all. That's not out of the realm of normalcy. So within my first 2 or 3 hours in this state, that was my first experience. I remember my freshman orientation, and feel free to stop me whenever. Yeah, my freshman orientation, there was a presentation where my friend, another First Wave alum, like First Cohort alum, Dinesh Smith, he's doing amazing things, by the way, he had taken a picture of the Black Venom doll, the Spider-Man Venom doll, hanging over Badger House, which actually isn't a fraternity, it's just on Langdon. But yeah, somebody decided to take a Venom doll, like a life-size one, wrap it on a noose, and throw it over a balcony, and he took a picture of it. So a couple months after that, the CEO organization was trying to repeal affirmative action. You know how these organizations try to do that every couple of years or so, like, or at least once or twice a year. It's very cyclical. A lot of conversations in this town are very, very cyclical. We have the same affirmative action is stupid debate. We have the same I'm not racist debate. We have somebody from somewhere doing something racially charged and then seeing little to no punishment for it. Maybe they get moved from to a different dorm. Maybe they just have to apologize, but, you know, it's tiring.
And you made that critique about listening, that UW has taken this sort of listening stance. And I saw that in a lot of the tweets in response to the Real UW hashtag, that UW said, you know, keep going, we're listening. You're saying maybe that's not enough. And now we have some action points from the UW, from the chancellor, who wants a program of cultural competency activities, more counseling services, an improved campus cultural center, maybe where everyone's under one big roof together. And also learning about hate incidents and campus disciplinary procedures. Does that sound like a good start to you to address this?
It sounds like we've done it before. It sounds like Plan 2008. you have to keep these goals very wide to make it seem like you're reaching them. So if we get 4 or 5 years deeper into a plan of some sort and we're still having the same discussions and the same complaints, if you've taken even a remote step, whether that's hiring somebody, whether that's hiring a woman, whether that's hiring a person of color, whether that's hiring a queer person, it's like, it looks like we're going forward, but then we just keep regressing into this listening phase. That's great to hear on paper, but we need practicality and we need money. We need the logistics to make this happen. Furthermore, you do not need to expect your students to play the role of educator over and over again. That's not what we signed up for. You should be giving us the salary. You should be giving us the tenure.
What do you mean by that, having your students play educator? What is that? What does that mean?
I'm saying that to say, I'll speak on my own experience as a black male, which obviously is my experience, not the experience. I don't mean to imply that at all. We've done a lot of educating, whether that's pulling people to the side, or that's trying to stop people from slurring, whether that's breaking up for white men on Langdon, jumping one of my Latino friends. Like, me and seven of my other friends just walked out to Langdon one time and saw our friend getting jumped. Had to break it up. Like, 5 or 6 people who had to break this entire thing up, like, push people back in a circle, try to stop them from getting cheap shots off at them. My friends' friends are crying because, like, they're, like, wondering what's going on. Police car ends up coming down the block. The dude runs away. We're all pointing at him, saying, he did it. Look, and he also hit a woman in the face right there, like, 5 minutes ago. Like, it's him. No arrests. Not even a detain, you know? Just ran up the block, kept the lights off, kept it moving. I say that to say, it's part of the process, you know, and I'm happy that I was able to acquire these skills personally to effectively dialogue and communicate with individuals from other backgrounds, especially when it comes to being flagrant or being disrespectful to my culture in particular. But I shouldn't have to come into this space, into this predominantly white space, with the expectation of having to just share all of this knowledge for nothing if you want to keep listening and then not going forward with your plan in an effective way that's producing real results.
We're talking with Michael Penn Jr. He's a graduate of UW-Madison and the First Wave program there, and he's been part of the Real UW hashtag conversation on Twitter. And Michael, one thing that people talk about when you look at instances where there might be an atmosphere of fear, of bigotry, is it impacts learning.
Indeed.
How can you focus on that? Did you find that to be the case, or was this something that was more like white noise?
More so around me. I kind of just had to tuck my head down because I knew I was going to finish no matter what, but I can't say the same for a lot of my peers. They can't necessarily focus on a class when their body is always at risk no matter where they walk and when they wake up. You know, it's difficult to focus on graduating from college when Tony Robinson gets shot. You know, it's difficult to focus on insert exam here when another non-indictment comes down the pipe, even if it's not Wisconsin, if it's New York, if it's Chicago, et cetera, et cetera. It comes with a certain territory that people aren't coming in to this university experience on the same baseline, giving off all these made up markers like race, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the reality that's been formed, that's been crafted for it. So it's something that we have to not only embrace, but endure. Try to be very careful, you know. It's Can you run the question for me one more time? Because I'm trying to just make sure I address this thoroughly.
Does it get in the way of learning, graduating?
Yes.
The big goals.
Yes.
Is why
okay.
The
yeah,
reason
yeah, yeah.
you're
the
at the
big
university.
Goals. The reason why. Yes. Not to be, you know, not to be like basically an unpaid, untenured TA to my to people who want to call me nigga all day. You know, like not that, but just focusing on the class. You know, focusing on the learning environment. Like, how do you sit, cope in a learning environment when you feel like you're always endangered? When you feel like you don't have the resources to be protected necessarily, not even out of intentionality of not protecting someone, but a person in a position of power, be it a TA or a professor, that lacks the competency to effectively do that, whether it's someone saying something ridiculous in class, whether it's an RA who may not know how to understand or handle like a racial thing, or even just kids who go through this university and can't even finish because of the serious psychological toll and mental health toll that this place can have on individuals of color and et cetera, et cetera. It's a lot to take in. It's a lot to digest. And I'm thankful that I was able to get through 4 years. And I'm thankful that I've been able to tuck my own head down. But I can't say the same for everyone else. And regardless, there's been incidences and instances in my own college career where I feel like I really needed some type of help and needed some type of institutional support, but I didn't trust myself to go seek it, for one, and two, because I felt like even if I would have went to another person, I don't think much would be done, because the precedent is nothing really gets done. When someone who lived on my floor in Chadbourne, for example, when I was a sophomore, called me a goddamn nigger during my president debate, you know, like, it didn't even occur to me to go to my house fellow. Not like I didn't think she was competent in doing her job. I was like, this is what I signed up for. You know, like, I'm a black person. I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. Like, this is going to happen again. Like, there's no point in running and snitching. So I didn't do that. Like, 19-year-old me didn't do that.
Would you do that differently now?
Absolutely.
Mean, there's a whole different context now, right? Because there's the Black Lives Matter movement, which isn't just happening in Wisconsin. It's happening across the country. And it seems like there's a consciousness change happening. So do you think that will shift things a little?
I would definitely hope so, and I'm going to do whatever it takes in my own power with my own devices to make sure that I to see that through, to make sure that I try to contribute what I can. And I just think I have these moments where 22-year-old me would do stuff way differently than 19-year-old me, but I would hope so, just because we're rising in this consciousness thing. I mean, even though that's that type of language I'm careful of too, you know, given like, oh, I'm woke, like being woke is just a moment and then you understand everything about the world. I don't understand everything about the world and I never will. I'm just trying to learn like everyone else. Like, I'm not in a position to be perfect or to preach down to anyone else. I'm just trying to share what I know because I know what I've experienced. I know what my friends are experiencing. And this is not an issue that can be solved with one side. This is not an issue that we can approach in a one-sided nature, you know?
I'm going to leave it there. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate you.
Michael Penn II is a recent graduate of UW-Madison and its First Wave program. Today, he's a rapper and a facilitator. He's been part of the ongoing conversation using the Real UW hashtag on social media.
Coming up in just a few moments, Ken Rudin, political junkie, and today's weird election. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're now joined by Ken Rudin, the political junkie. His show, The Political Junkie, will air Friday nights at 7 on the Ideas Network starting tomorrow. Ken, hello again.
I'm thinking if this is the weirdest election in history, we might as well have the weirdest phone connection in history as well.
Exactly. But we've got you now, and
that's
we've
right.
got this election going on. So we were talking earlier, and we heard you a little bit. Can this get any weirder? Are there any more weird twists and turns that you're watching for?
Oh, it hasn't started yet. And here's why it hasn't started yet. Because for the first time, well, let's see. I mean, basically, for the first time since 1976, it looks like we're headed to a contested convention in Cleveland in July. And what I mean by a contested convention is that a candidate does not go into the convention with a majority of the delegates. The Republicans need the Republican to be nominated on the first ballot. Republican needs 1,237 delegates. Right now, Donald Trump's going to have to do very well, mean like winning 60% of the remaining delegates to get that number. If he doesn't, then chaos could very well happen in Cleveland. Basically, Donald Trump's says if he doesn't get the nomination on the first ballot, there'll be riots at the convention. And if he does get the convention, if he does get the nomination, there are a lot of Republicans who say, oh, my goodness, we are in big trouble in November against Hillary Clinton or whomever the Democrats put up. So either way, you're going to have a wild time and a crazy time, unpredictable time in Cleveland at the convention.
And Ken, the name Paul Ryan is not going anywhere either, even though Paul Ryan says, stop talking about me, not going to happen. His name is still out there as maybe a third choice.
Well, Veronica, remember when Paul Ryan said, there's no way I'm going to be Speaker of the House either, and he suddenly became Speaker of the House. So Paul Ryan's name has been mentioned. But look at it this way. Think of all the voters who have voted for Ted Cruz or Donald Trump since the Iowa caucuses. You go to the Cleveland Convention, and somehow these Republican elites say, okay, you know what? Let's name Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney or somebody else or John Kasich, who's won Ohio and nothing else. I mean, that, you know, might be a true rebellion among delegates in Cleveland. So either you get a Donald Trump or a Ted Cruz, neither of whom is the most popular Republican on the face of the earth, or you get a non-candidate at the moment or somebody other than those two, and then those Trump and Cruz supporters say, wait a second, what about all this work I've done for my candidate? Suddenly you're going to take the nomination and give it to somebody who has not even been in contention until now. So that's why I'm thinking that it could be just utter chaos. The last time a Republican convention went beyond one ballot was 1948, when Thomas Dewey won it on the third ballot. But this one looks like not only chaos, but it could be like bad blood and recriminations that can go all the way through November.
Ken, as you know, we voted in Wisconsin on Tuesday. Usually these primaries, the national media, they don't call, they don't write. This time we got all the attention. What did you make of what you saw in Wisconsin this time around?
Well, I love it. I mean, as I said earlier with my very low voice earlier in the show, that I said that it's the first time in history that the two winners in Wisconsin were not the front runners. You have Bernie Sanders winning big on the Democratic side. You have Ted Cruz winning big on the Republican side. Neither one is likely, or at least at this point, likely to win the nomination on the first ballot. But it just shows what Wisconsin is all about. It's independent. It's progressive. It's different. It's learned. It's obviously one of the more highly educated states in the country. I'm not saying that because Sanders and Cruz won, but Wisconsin voters has always been a large turnout. They know their candidates. They know what the issues are. And it was just, it wasn't a surprise that either Cruz or Sanders won, because that's what the polls showed. But boy, it sure changes a lot of minds, because we keep watching, on March 15th, Hillary Clinton swept all those big five states, Ohio, Illinois, North Carolina, Florida, and Missouri. And everybody said, okay, Bernie's done. Then comes the next couple of weeks, including Wisconsin, and now Bernie Sanders has won six of the last seven, and people are saying, wait a second, there may be a Democratic race after all. Same thing on the Republican side. Donald Trump won everything except Ohio on March 15th. He's a shoo-in. Everybody else should drop out. And now you look at the numbers, you look at, one, the things that Trump has been saying over the last couple of weeks, and two, the numbers that we saw out of Wisconsin, and people say, well, maybe this guy could be stopped after all. So Wisconsin, has not had its moment in the sun in a long time. I remember it was Eugene McCarthy's first victory in 1968. It was George McGovern's first victory in 1972. Back in the day, boy, do I sound like an old-timer, but back in the day, Wisconsin played a huge role. Jimmy Carter barely beat Mo Udall in 76 by a percentage point or two. It always made a big difference in the old days, but more recently, the nomination battle had been over so early that Wisconsin never had its say. It had its say this week.
Nice to have our moment in the sun. And Ken, it's great talking to you, and we look forward to hearing more of you on Friday night.
Yeah, I can't wait to be. I'm very happy to be on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much.
That's Ken Rudin, political commentator and election historian. He hosts the weekly program, Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, which will air Friday nights at 7 on the Ideas Network starting tomorrow.
Coming up, the so-called Panama Papers revealed tax evasion through offshore accounts. But our guest says that in the U.S., creating a shell company to avoid taxes is very easy, easier than in Panama. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7, it's storytelling time on the Moth Radio Hour. A boy's bar mitzvah becomes a family battleground, and a novelist decides that the only way to cure her writer's block is to block out the world. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, this week saw the largest leak of financial information in history. The Panama Papers are 11.5 million files belonging to a Panama-based firm that helps wealthy politicians, business moguls, celebrities, and others create offshore bank accounts.
Offshore bank accounts aren't necessarily illegal, but they are known to be used to hide money and transactions and to avoid paying taxes. Since the leak, politicians like Vladimir Putin, the prime ministers of Iceland and Pakistan, and celebrities like Simon Cowell and Jackie Chan have all been tied to the Panamanian firm that helps create offshore accounts.
Compared to other countries, there are relatively few Americans' names coming up in the Panama Papers. Our next guest says that actually might be because the U.S. is one of the easiest countries in the world to hide your assets. Easier, maybe, than Panama, in fact.
Joining us now is Shruti Shah, Vice President of the anti-corruption organization Transparency International USA. Shruti, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So is it really easier to hide your money in the United States than it is in Panama?
I wouldn't say it's easier, but it is one of the easiest places in the world to actually form an anonymous company. So, for example, to form an LLC in Delaware, you just need the name of the LLC, you need the address of the registered office, the name of the registered agent, and the witness signature. So you don't actually even need your own name or your own address. You don't need to prove your identity.
So where does the U.S. stand as a potential tax haven?
It's not so much the fact that it is a tax haven, because, of course, the anonymous companies are used to shield people from taxes as well. But the real issue is that because of this anonymity, because when you form an anonymous company, you don't really know who the natural person is that controls the company or derives benefits from a company, they are misused by money launderers, arms traffickers, and even people for bribery. So, like, some of the famous people who used anonymous companies include our former Louisiana Congressman Jefferson, who got caught with $90,000 of bribe money in his freezer. And guess what? He used anonymous shell companies, which helped him facilitate the bribery.
We're using the term shell company here. Tell us what that is.
Well, shell company is really a company which is just a shell. It has no economic activity. There's really not much to it. And you can't actually tell who the true natural person is who owns the company. It could be owned by another company, which could be owned by yet another company in an offshore haven. So it's very difficult to trace who's behind the company.
Now, not everyone obviously uses the anonymity of LLCs in the United States and Delaware, you mentioned, to hide their assets. So how big of a problem, or is this even a problem that the United States should be looking at?
First of all, it is a very big problem, and it is a problem that the United States should be looking at. I agree with you that not everybody who forms a company in the United States does it for money laundering or to shield their taxes or to, you know, facilitate bribery. But the fact is that because there are so many loopholes in the system, it makes it very easy for those who want to do so. And I'll give you a personal example. I mean, my library card has expired. In fact, I sent my husband to return an overdue library book, and he found out my library card had expired. And what happened was that I was told I would need either a utility bill, which showed my current address, or a driver's license with my current address to renew my library card. I live in Arlington, Virginia. I wouldn't need any of those things to open up an anonymous company. Anonymous companies have really been used, not just for money laundering, but they've been used even to scam the federal government. There have been several cases of defense contractors conning the U.S. military. There was one case where they conned the U.S. military into paying inflated prices for food and water for our troops. When you're doing business with someone, you kind of want to know who they are. There is no excuse for not knowing who you're doing business with, and that goes for the U.S. government, but that also goes for ordinary people. Anonymous companies have been used to trick the elderly people out of their savings. All of this is terrible.
Now, a state might decide to put policies like this into place because they want a business-friendly economy, a place where businesses are going to start up and bring money into the state. Is changing some of what you're talking about, making it more transparent, is that likely to depress the economy or discourage business growth?
It shouldn't. It shouldn't discourage any legitimate business. And, you know, the laws that I'm talking about, there is a law in Congress in Corporation Transparency and Law Enforcement Assistance Act, which would require states to collect information about who the natural person is that benefits from a company or controls a company upon company formation. But that legislation, it has not yet been enacted, but that bill has been introduced in Congress. That wouldn't require that information to be made public. It would just require it to be collected and say if law enforcement needs it, they would use a subpoena to get that information. So why would it discourage legitimate business? There is no reason. Of course, if you're a money launderer, you might be deterred.
We're talking right now with Shruti Shah, Vice President of Transparency International USA, and we're talking about the Panama Papers right now. And Shruti, were you surprised that there were not more American names revealed in this information leak?
So let me just say, this is still the tip of the iceberg. We'll see more revelations in the times to come. But with regard to American names, I mean, why I don't need to open up an anonymous company in Panama or the British Virgin Islands when I can do it right here at home in the U.S.
Would you expect that now that we've seen this leak, that this issue that you're talking about and you've been active in for some time, that this is going to start getting more attention?
I think so. I think that radio shows such as this one and, you know, several other shows kind of are covering this extensively. And people are so interested in this issue and they are so shocked and appalled by the loopholes in our system. And they're trying to figure out why banks have been complicit in this and what's going on. An ordinary citizen who pays taxes and say if you're a nurse or a teacher and you can't afford to buy a house in Miami or Manhattan, wherever you live, it's partly because a lot of real estate in the U.S. is now owned through anonymous shell companies, and they are driving up prices, which make houses unaffordable for ordinary people. There are real consequences for ordinary American citizens, and I think people are now delving into it and understanding it, and I think time has come for change. So I would encourage any of your viewers to write to their members of Congress, particularly to the House Finance Committee, which has the power to hold a hearing on this legislation.
Well, speaking of real-life consequences, do you have any sense of what kind of tax revenue the United States might be missing out on?
No, taxes is not my specialty, so I don't. But there are several other organizations which have had estimations of, you know, the tax revenue that's being lost. I mean, certainly a lot. But taxes are not the only reason why people use anonymous companies. They could be using it for several reasons, including because they don't want people to find out who they are. They don't want their business contractors and subcontractors to find out who they really are. There have been cases where people have been debarred from doing business with the federal government, and they've gone on and formed another company and continued to do business with the government. And, you know, you can't find out. And some of those are unsavory characters. So for all of those reasons, it's time to change this anonymity right now.
Is there a political appetite right now to do just that, do you think?
I would say that there was some political appetite, but not all that much. But with the Panama leaks, we are seeing a shift. This morning, I read in the New York Times that Treasury was going to speed up the finalization of the rule, which would require financial institutions to determine who really the natural person was behind their corporate client. And they had proposed that rule in 2014, but it had never been finalized. The fact that banks are not explicitly required to know the natural person behind an anonymous company is staggering, and it's a huge loophole. And I read this morning that they're going to speed that up.
Shruti, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Shruti Shah, Vice President of the anti-corruption organization Transparency International USA. She joined us to talk about the Panama Papers and why she says it's also easy to hide assets here in the United States.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This morning, a new trailer came out for a movie that's going to be a new take on the Star Wars franchise. It's called Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Let's take a listen.
State your name for the record.
Jyn Erso.
Forgery of imperial documents. Possession of stolen property. Aggravated assault. Resisting arrest.
On your own from the age of 15. Reckless, aggressive, and undisciplined.
This is a rebellion, isn't it?
I rebel.
It all takes place in Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, and Han Solo's world in a galaxy far away, but the plot takes place just before the original movie and Luke Skywalker's story begins in the 1977 film.
The spinoff follows rebels who are trying to steal plans to the Death Star and features Oscar nominee Felicity Jones and other up-and-coming actors.
Now, we are longtime Star Wars fans here at Central Time. We want to hear from you. Are you a fan of the Star Wars saga or one part of it, maybe not another? How do you feel about the new life on the franchise? A lot of new movies scheduled to come out over the next bunch of years. Excited, looking forward to them, dreading them. Your call. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Watch the trailer while you're there if you'd like. That's 800-642-1234. Now, you and I drop Star Wars quotes around the office all the time.
Of course, now that you say that, I can't think of a single one.
I've got a bad feeling about this.
You sure do. Then. I shouldn't have come. I'm endangering the mission.
Exactly. So, yeah, this kind of thing happens behind the scenes here all the time at Central Time. And new movies. Do you look forward to them?
Oh, totally. I will not be there at opening night. I'm not that person
anymore.
You're
not going to camp out in line.
I was that person at one point, but not anymore. But I'll definitely go within the first couple weeks, for sure.
And I'll see it. But when Phantom Menace came out, I was really excited. It kind of let me down in sort of a betrayal of a childhood memory sense. So I'll watch them.
That was the Jar Jar Binks series?
It was indeed. Uh-huh. So yeah, it didn't do it for me. So my lesson is don't get excited about these now. Now it's your turn to weigh in at 800-642-1234. Is Star Wars, the series, a particular movie, a part of your life? Was it a part of your childhood? If so, which one? Are you introducing the movies maybe to a new generation? What did the epic movie mean to you? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We also talked to some of our colleagues here.
That's right. WPR News Director Noah Oshinsky says, I'm a Star Wars fanatic and will go see the film regardless of what the critics say. If it has the word Star Wars in the title, I'm good for at least one ticket.
And Chris Molina, who's worked with us here at Central Time over the years, he says not a Star Wars mega fan. He's seen the movies, enjoyed them, but he has a hard time, he says, getting aboard the hype train for the new movie. He says he doesn't like watching movie trailers. It always spoils the best, most fun parts anyway. But if people enjoy it, he says, and he's a forgiving guy, he says, more power to him.
Ah, oh, that's generous.
That's
of Chris
so Chris.
Molina.
That's so Chris.
Yeah, I think that it's going to be good. I like that they chose to pick up right beforehand because it feels more familiar. I think the Jar Jar era, it just didn't feel that familiar. It didn't feel that Star Wars-y. So I am actually excited about the timing of where they're putting it.
And what didn't do it for me about the preview is, hey, there's this character, Anakin Skywalker. He seems like a nice enough fella, but you know he's Darth Vader later. And I think you really needed like an ultimate dramatic actor and portrayal to show to make that interesting. Well, let's let you weigh in now. Let's get to our callers at 800-642-1234. Fawn starts us off in Madison. Fawn, hi.
Hi. Well, I saw the first ever Star Wars when I was a kid, and I've seen the last. I skipped the ones that were not so well received, I guess. but the last one I saw, and I'm looking forward to seeing this one actually, in part because I didn't know this in advance about the last film, but that it had a female main character. But I'm happy to see that the next one will too. And I think this franchise is moving forward into our cultural evolution, as it were, to really understand that females are as important and active and able as male characters and male actors. And I especially with the reactions by the toy company, was it Hasbro, that outright refused to make a female likeness of the protagonist of the last film. And
that was so interesting. That was just some good points, Fawn. And you're right. And there's another female protagonist. And they're not only just like lead characters. They really kick some butt in the movies. They're tough. They're warriors. So this is a new thing for Star Wars.
Thanks for that call, Fawn. And we'll go next to Andrew in La Crosse. Andrew, hi.
Hi. I actually brought my family in on the Clone Wars, which deals with Obi-Wan and Anakin. It's kind of between the second and third movies before he went to the dark side. And I think it's really good just because it builds on everybody so much more than you can in the movies.
That's the animated series. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Andrew. Well, you can keep sharing your favorite Star Wars memories, moments, whether you anticipate new movies, whether you dread them. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Probably not. And we've got that trailer up over there. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Wisconsin's public universities are making changes after lawmakers approved another round of cuts and tuition freezes for UW system last year. Declining enrollment, debt, and a lack of reserve funds at UW-Superior has left the campus unable to absorb the cuts. As Danielle Kading reports, fewer dollars on campus means fewer programs for students.
Caleb Schmidt tried out a few UW schools before settling on somewhere close to home. The junior is studying Broadfield Social Studies at UW-Superior.
Because I want to be a teacher for some reason. Probably over half the people who are influential in my own life are teachers, so I feel like if I can give that back to someone else, that'd be great.
Schmidt is taking a break from classes in the school's new student center. It's one of two building projects that contributed to the university's looming $4.5 million shortfall 2 years back. He's aware of cuts on campus, but he says UW-Superior's ongoing financial challenges aren't really on his radar.
Blissfully ignorant.
That may be, but Broadfield Social Studies is one of 16 programs that remain under review due to low enrollment. Declining enrollment, state aid cuts, and tuition freezes prompted the university to begin reviewing all programs in 2013. So far, UWS has suspended 20 programs and cut dozens of faculty and staff. Now the campus must absorb its share of $250 million the legislature cut from state funding for higher ed.
Our cut was around $850,000, just a little bit over that amount.
That's UWS Chancellor Renee Wachter. UW-Superior officials say the cuts made on campus already trimmed the deficit roughly in half, from $4.5 million to $2 million. Wachter says there are no plans to cut more positions or programs for now.
If things would have been cut, they would have been cut during this last round. We sort of formally said that program prioritization is over, but there are programs that still have to execute the plans that they have put in place.
That means Broadfield Social Studies and the 15 other programs still under review are working through plans to prevent future cuts. Theater professor Kathy Fank says she's working on bringing business courses into the theater major to attract more students.
All I know is that I need to attract as many students as I possibly can to my program area.
Otherwise, Fank says the program may see its final curtain call.
And the last two measures.
Students are rehearsing 60s songs for this spring's musical in the university's theater. Stage manager and freshman Nicole Schlescherbecht hasn't decided what she wants to major in yet, but she says the program played a big role in her decision to go to UWS.
It was something that I was really interested in. I wasn't going to go from being completely immersed in theater in high school to nothing.
But Fank says state aid cuts are chipping away at what UWS can offer.
That's why we don't have as many teachers in any area as we have. It all comes back to the money. One way or another, it's going to come back to the money. Or what drives the money, which is the students.
Hazelhurst Republican Tom Tiffany sat on the budget's Joint Finance Committee last year. Tiffany says challenges may exist, but he believes there's fat to be shaved from UW system.
As long as we maintain that instructional time, I think these are very good changes. And I think our UW system is going to be able to meet the challenges of the 21st century.
As UWS adjusts, Chancellor Renee Wachter says they're focusing on growing and keeping the students they have. For students like Schmidt and Schlesserbecht, that could depend on whether the people or programs they love are here to stay. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, Rich Kramer takes a look at how budget cuts are affecting UW-Eau Claire.